We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books Network, the podcast where we delve into the latest academic publications and the minds behind them. I'm your host, Garima Jaju, and our guest today is Dr. Timothy Cooper, Leverhulme Research Fellow at the Department of Anthropology at the University of Cambridge. We're in conversation today about his new book, Moral Atmospheres, Islam and Media in a Pakistani Marketplace, published by Columbia University Press. The book manuscript was awarded the 2022 Claremont Prize from the Institute of Religion, Culture, and Public Life at Columbia University. Tim, welcome to the show. We're so thrilled to have you with us today.
Thanks, Garima. Nice to be here.
Tim, your journey into anthropology is quite interesting, especially given your background in film and media. So can we maybe start with you sharing a little about how you came into anthropology and how you blend these disciplines into your ethnographic practice? Because in the book, you demonstrate a very unique sensitivity to visual and auditory details that really enliven your ethnographic descriptions of media landscapes of, you know, urban spaces like Hall Road in Lahore that you write about. So let's start on a biographical note to understand the disciplinary make of you as an anthropologist.
Thank you ever so much. So I came to anthropology from a background, as you say, in film and media studies, but particularly the study of production of and curation of experimental film and artist moving image media. So I studied this for undergraduate and postgraduate in London, and I also worked for two kind of film lab and film cooperatives in London. So the London Filmmakers Co-op was kind of died in the late 90s, and out of it sprung two different organizations. One was called Nowhere, that got the equipment, you know, the enlargers, the archive, the, you know, optical equipment, and the other was Lux, which got the film library. And I did some workshops with Lux and worked with them for a bit, and then also kind of was an intern and did some curatorial work for Nowhere. And my interest was really in the image here, you know, its materiality, how celluloid ages and decays, how digital files glitch, and the ways that we can play with these and experiment with them in creative formats to, you know, speak to different forms of kind of age and decay and degradation. Yeah, I was working in London at this time, and it was around 2012 when Boris Johnson became mayor of London that me and all of my friends decided to leave London and never come back. And the company I was working for at the time had offices in Pakistan, and I knew very little about the country, but it was a way to go. It was a way to leave. And so I moved to Pakistan in 2012 and spent about 6 months there. And kind of quite naturally, the way I came to learn about this place that I genuinely didn't know much about before going there was through my previous interests in film. I was also writing at the time for contemporary arts publications like Freeze magazine, a magazine called Art Papers. There was this collective, I don't think exists anymore, in New York called RISM. And there was another online publication called Ibraz. And I was writing for these. And the cool thing at the time was the archival turn, which in contemporary art, which kind of studied how, you know, forms of material collection and archiving can foster forms of, you know, collective and public memory in the absence of more formal archival situations. So all of this animated my thinking when I moved to this place that I didn't know much about. And as I say, I came to engage this new environment through these previous interests. And after living in Pakistan and finding that there were things that I wanted to know more about, film studies, as much as I love its epistemology and theory, it didn't seem like a way that I could go somewhere and ask people questions and, you know, get really into the depth of how things work. So I was reading the work of Brian Larkin, who wrote on media infrastructure in Nigeria. And I was also reading the work of Chris Pinney, who would later become my PhD supervisor, who works on visual culture in India and photography. And these things inspired me to come to anthropology. The only PhD program that would allow me to do a PhD without any background in the discipline was UCL. And so thanks to them, I took up anthropology.
Thanks. That's so fascinating. Because my next question is about the biography of the book and what is the origin story for this book and how it came to be. And I suspect that your own biography mirrors the ways in which your ideas around this book came to sort of evolve. How did you conceive of this book and what's the story?
Brilliant. Thank you. Yeah, so very much so. I mean, it closely mirrors what I just said, but so if I was interested when I was writing for these arts publications, if I was interested in the archival turn and, you know, forms of material collection and archiving, the thing that I expected, foolishly, what I expected to exist in Pakistan was a national film archive. I now realize that this was an unusual thing to project onto a place, but, you know, such are the follies of youth. But being one of the largest film producing countries in the world at a certain point, I expected there to be kind of some state or government backed way of fostering film culture. And when I found that there wasn't, I was kind of, you know, more interested in and surprised. But then what surprised me more was that Lollywood film, so Lollywood is the, you know, the local Lahore-based industry that, you know, quite specifically refers to Urdu language and Punjabi language film, but in a certain sense, kind of is the infrastructural basis for other language cinema industries like Pashto film, which was in part made in Lahore studios. So I was surprised that Lollywood film was always widely available, that I could get hold of any of these films, no matter how old or rare they were. I could find a copy of them in media markets on VCD or DVD. And this surprised me. And so the thing that I was fascinated by was why these films exist in the present. What networks did they travel through? What kind of anxieties and animosities and affinities did they, you know, gave them shape as they came into the present? And so I turned my attention to the people from whom I sourced these films, who were marketplace media traders in several different parts of Lahore. But the site that I settled upon was a large street called Hall Road, which was created as a kind of, you know, service street on the side of the Lahore Cathedral Church of the Resurrection. That after the British colonial church used to be the tomb of Anarkali, which was first a public, no, first it was a church, then it was a public records office, and when it stopped being a church, they wanted to make their own. So they built this very large church, and one of the side streets was Hall Road. And over the years, it became first a place where people serviced radios, then it became a place where people serviced and repaired early, you know, reel-to-reel sound recorders. Then it became a place that imported VHS players. Then it became the center, in South Asia at least, of film and media piracy. So this is where Bollywood films would be smuggled across the border to Lahore, where they would be copied en masse, or master copies would then go to Dubai or London, and they would move around there. So this wasn't just a place of, you know, organization. It was a place of production as well. So in the top floors of these large, what are known as plazas, you know, you had like 300 VHS players wired together that would pump out these copies into the world. So film, in its circulatory form, was really closely aligned with this street, Hall Road. So this seemed like a natural place for me to spend some time and do some work. So I went back in 2017 to 2020 and did what was 18 months of field work for that informed this book. What I should also say, that I forgot to say earlier, was that while I came to engage Pakistan, this place that I didn't know much about through my background in film, it's only partially true. In late 2012, when I moved to Pakistan, to Lahore, this was only a few months after countrywide riots destroyed dozens of important old urban cinemas. So in a sense, although I went looking for film, film and public morality were also, in a sense, found me. So what was happening at this time in late 2012 was you had this crude and amateur and to some people blasphemous mini film that was uploaded in the United States to YouTube. And following this, YouTube was banned in Pakistan for 4 years, but immediately after its release and the kind of outrage on the part of some groups in response to it, some mobs went around and torched Pakistan cinemas, particularly in Karachi, but some also in Lahore. And so there was this climate of questioning what place film and its kind of public iteration should play in the contemporary form that Pakistan takes. So all of this came together into an emerging interest, which, as is the very nature of fieldwork, you kind of unpack and make sense of while you're there.
Oh, that's so fascinating. I've written down film in circulatory form. And that's such a brilliant way to put it, because that's what this book does. It's not just, you know, confined within what the film is, but the way it moves and who are the people moving it. So maybe let's just dive straight into the book and start with the central concept of moral atmospheres, which holds the book together. It's a really intriguing concept. You describe these atmospheres as both spatial and diffuse, meaning that they're tied to specific places like the Hall Road that you just described, but also they permeate beyond these physical boundaries, mixing with other affects, moral forces, even other particulate matters. And they carry with them a definitive moral authority, but they're also marked by ambiguity and contradictions. So could you maybe explain to our listeners what these atmospheres are and how they function, especially how you are conceiving of them as what you call vital social formations and not just mere contexts or backdrops? I'm just curious to hear more about this core idea holding the book.
Thank you very much. So when I began working on Hall Road, which was the field site I settled upon, my interlocutors were the film and media traders who work there. So this is a large media market of around at least 25 to 30,000 people. I say media. I mean, its reputation in the film trade was kind of on the wane when I was there, but it was still a very important kind of way you got hold of films and music and sound. When I was there, it also was becoming a kind of market for navigating infrastructural intermittence. So there were whole streets where you would buy kind of power banks to charge your phone when load shedding happened. There were solar panels personal solar panels that you would use when there were kind of citywide blackouts. It was a place that was all about the environmental qualities of media. So even before I came to Atmosphere, I was interested in, media environment and the environmental qualities of media. Now, the film and media traders who I ended up working with were fascinating people because they were, you know, really riven with conflict and moral torment about their trade. So these are people who are what you might describe as cinephiles, you know, lovers of film, you know, they're collectors of film culture, they are singers of film songs, you know, they're advocates for an industry that's long been insulted and maligned. But they're also, these people are also very devoted Muslims from Pakistan's majority denomination, who perhaps more than others are encouraged to be skeptical about moving image media and its place in their lives and the lives of others. So my work was initially driven by this disjuncture between how these film traders felt about film and how they acted in relation to it. After speaking with, you know, several groups of who became friends at length, what I learned was that there was quite an important analytic that they were using to describe the difference between, you know, the clear-cut sense of them as bounded individuals and the kind of unruly public dispersions of film. And this was their speculations on film's mohol. So mohol is a kind of Hindustani term derived from Arabic, which I translate as atmosphere. Now, other than when it refers to the biophysical, the way the term mohol is used is almost always morally situated. It describes the effect on you as an individual, as a thinking, feeling person, but also it can be the means of being affected as well. So you are affected by atmospheres, and in so being affected, you create them, in a sense. In the back of my mind, I think I must have thought when I first heard it, but when I started hearing it enough, I thought that this must have been a salient term of analysis for the kinds of things I was interested in, which was film, sound, moving image media. Now, people have been writing about the atmosphere of film since the earliest days of the film medium. So even before film theory, you got people talking about atmosphere in the coming together of light, you know, the bodies of strangers in a confined place, the real and imagined movement on the screen, you know, that kind of intermittence between sound and silence. But when people in Lahore used it in relation to film, it was usually a judgment that referred to negative influences. But in all the ways it was used, mohol as atmosphere was moral because one defines values, behaviors, and attitudes in relation to it. So interested in this kind of emic analytic, I very much did not go to the field thinking I was going to be doing a study of atmosphere or engage phenomenological concepts. My initial attempt was to do a grounded material culture study in the circulation of Pakistani film in the absence of a national film archive. I was interested in, you know, heritage, people doing things, collective memory, things like that. I didn't intend for this to be about atmosphere at all, but it was what my interlocutors cared about, and it was what helped them to describe and define how something that appears to be a contradiction, which is the central, you know, problem the book contends with, which is traders in film who describe film as impermissible. Atmosphere for them is something that allows coexistent forces to intersect, temporarily cohabit, you know, chime off one another and then move on. It's even when you have a public sphere in which few people agree about the form and role and the modes and media that Islam should play in public life, you find sometimes the thing that they do agree on is atmosphere, is their agreement that this fosters a good one, this fosters a bad one, this is ambivalent, this is ambiguous. And I was interested in how these kind of mobile, moving, and volumetric forms take shape in relation to film as this kind of overarching anxiety in public culture.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night, ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga, Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Okay, I have a clarifying question. Holroad, as you describe it, constitutes a dense media ecology where it's not just film and media, but a whole host of film and media adjacent objects and goods that are being traded. So it's not just film that is moving in circulatory form, but also other objects like a mobile phone charger or a video recorder. So my question is how we are able to isolate and remove films out of this dense ecology and focus on just films, removing other objects that that also crowd Holroad.
That's a brilliant question. And the answer to that would be that we're not in the book. So, in material culture studies, you hear people talking about object communities, about communities of things that bear some kind of relationship with one another. Doing a very kind of, you know, because I was on Holroad for a very, very long time, I did crazy things like make maps about of where, you know, of where a line of traders in cooling fans for desktop PCs segued into a street that sold domestic cooling fans and punker, ceiling fans, right? And so there's definitely, if not a logic, but there's some kind of serendipitous community on Holroad and its environs that relates to forms of airborne and environmental media, right? It could be several things. It could be that the scale of the city's population growth has led to infrastructural intermittence and breakdown on such a scale that this market that already had extensive trade links with the Gulf and China and all over the world could capitalize on these links, majoring the film trade to buy cheaply made, you know, goods that help navigate these contemporary problems. That's one way of looking at it. Or it could be that there's something airborne about film. There's something kind of volumetric about film, which means it sits quite comfortably among these kinds of objects. And that would be my argument. So in the way that in some places you'll hear the term video refer to several different forms of moving image media. So the term video in the UK or America, for example, refers to perhaps also from video art to, you know, a YouTube video to TikTok. It's a kind of blanket term that keeps a lot within it. In Pakistan, I would argue the term that does a similar thing is film, which refers to a kind of wide body of moving image forms. And the reason I think this is because from the earliest days of film exhibition in Muslim South Asia, there's been a real interest in how to define the moving image as an object of theological knowledge. And that is like in relation to the still image. So it's quite easy to deal with still images because the Quran and the Sunnah, have varied ways of interpreting this. People don't agree on them and often they're conflicting or ambiguous, but there is a set repertoire of how we deal with the still image. The moving image is a much different organism. It's a much more unruly and uncertain thing to take stock of. Now, the first theologians to deal with it, most famously Maududi, who was the founder of the Jamati Islami, one of the most important South Asian Islamist movements, he argued that film is very, very much permissible, you know, because it's, and he was writing about celluloid projection here, where you have 24 frames moving across a projection bulb. He argued that film is permissible because it's in no way an image, a picture. It never manifests into fixity. So the problem with the image is it's an affront to the creative agency of Allah. Whereas a moving image, it's more like a mirror, which is a form of figurative representation that's always been ruled okay, permissible. And so this interest in the airborne, ethereal, ambient qualities of film as something which is both out there in the world, it's kind of bottled time in that it's a celluloid reel or a DVD disc that has a set amount of time in it. Duration unfolds when you switch it on, and then it goes back in its case and then does the same thing later on. You also have its urban and material form. You have the kind of ambiguous place of cinema halls that are kind of alongside British colonial like infrastructure and architecture, like canals and universities and prisons, but are also kind of still there and not made for the same purpose. They have this ambiguity. With all of this, there's this uncertainty, which I think dominates film studies, this uncertainty about what is the object of film studies, you know? It can't just be the content, what actors do or what directors depict. It can't just be its movement, because it's not just a material form. There's something else about film, which if nothing else, is airborne, is volumetric, it's out there in the world. It's a form of, you know, moral infrastructure. So that's why I think it sits so well, or why it makes sense in these object communities that I didn't make up, that are there on Hall Road. I've forgotten the first part of your question.
So the question is about these object communities. And if, so a follow-up question, do the moral contestations that surround film also then extend to the film recording device? Or is that different because it doesn't share in the same quality of, you know, being ethereal and airborne?
That's interesting. No, I don't think I've read or heard anything that attacks the apparatus itself. Or even those who, you know, the technical professionals who deal with the apparatus. I've never heard any, I mean, I've heard questions on permissibility about things like, you know, being a projectionist or working in hospitality in a cinema hall. Yeah, but nothing, but kind of forms of questioning about their permissibility rather than rulings against them. It's the possibility of film. It's the uncertainty of what it does and can do.
Yeah, and different people enjoying, and different people and different objects enjoying different proximity and distance from it. And that tension runs throughout the book.
Okay, back to moral atmospheres. I wanted to explore a little this idea of moral ambiguity that moral atmospheres foster. You write that moral atmospheres thrive on moral opacity and obfuscation. In fact, it is this very ambiguity that makes it possible for people and things to coexist tolerably alongside other people and other things. Can we delve a little into how these atmospheres hold these tensions without seeking to resolve them?
Thank you. Another wonderful question. My encouragement to think about atmospheres as containers or as containers that hold often conflicting ideas or values together comes from the only theoretical framework that I found for atmosphere that seemed applicable. Now, when I was, so I finished my field work, most of it in 2018. I did like two or three months follow on work in 2020. In 2018, just as I was trying to make sense of atmosphere, this really wonderful book by a guy, Patrick Eisenlaw, was published, where he writes about atmosphere, and also very usefully writes about it in relation to Islamic naat recitations, which are kind of poems of praise for the Prophet Muhammad. So the way he theorizes atmosphere and the way he does it and backfills it with German neo-phenomenology, I found really useful. This being said, the kind of the framework of German neo-phenomenology was really helpful, yeah, but didn't seem like it fitted the bill of how to interpret Mohop. So the only really useful two sets of backfill reading I could engage with was a wonderful book by someone called Nida Kermani, which was the only other book to engage the, you know, analytic of Mohop, as she writes about it in the terms of Muslim minoritization in India as, you know, something that fosters a sense of, you know, belonging, a sense of containment in the sense of being held within and encapsulated. The other one was a really interesting musicologist and Muslim sage called Hazrat Inayat Khan. And he wrote a lot about, I mean, his work was a kind of philosophy of the airborne. He wrote about breath, he wrote about signals in the air. He was writing mainly in the 1910s and 1920s, so the era of, you know, wireless telegraphy, things like this, the coming of radio, you know. And the way he wrote about atmosphere was as this thing that holds together human signals and tones. And I found this really interesting and compelling. And it seemed to explain why people were using atmosphere to describe, you know, ethical precepts and moral situations or moral unease that couldn't be explained theologically or with recourse to jurisprudence. So where atmosphere comes in, I found, was in the absence or failure of a unifying pre-existing moral precept. So of course, in Pakistan, this would often take the form of, you know, rulings or at least guidelines that have been manifested in law or become kind of manifest as public norms. When you don't find an answer in any of that, that's when I heard people talking about atmosphere for something that they couldn't say was right or wrong, but that just, you know, felt wrong. So the one of the examples I can give is there was this court case that was taken to the Supreme Court in 2016 that was brought forward by the prosecution with the Jamati Islami, and the defendants were, and was a cinema distributor and exhibitor who was let out a cultural center that was built as an Islamic cultural center, but funds dried up and the building was vacant and it was let out to this film exhibitor. And the Jamati Islami felt that this was against the ideology of Pakistan and bought a court case. And there was no, you know, the building wasn't the product of a charitable endowment. It wasn't registered in the Karachi town regulations as an Islamic waqf. And so the way that the prosecution argued was that the coexistence of film and domes and the Shahada, the declaration of faith, felt wrong rather than was wrong. And they argued this so convincingly in relation to the kind of, you know, the impossibility that these two atmospheres of prayer and reflection and cinema attendance can coexist, meant that they won the case. So here you have these really interesting ways that kind of speculating on atmospheres creates these interesting temporary collectives of people, such as the Jamati Islami and Supreme Court judges. And this also, you see this at a much kind of smaller, not smaller, a much kind of more social immediate interface as well, in that you have instances where people who will disagree on everything else will agree that something affords, you know, a positive moral atmosphere, or something affords a particularly ambiguous, you know, mood, right? Now, this observation for me didn't seem like it was enough. It didn't seem like that was the end to the story as well. So the way I study atmospheres is I argue that atmospheres kind of, you know, gather form almost like cloud formations. And the vapor for the cloud formations, I argue, are what I call thresholds. Now, this is both my own use of the term threshold and also a kind of another emic category, which is the term hud or hudud in plural, which is a Islamic theological notion which refers to the social location of divine boundaries, which means there are boundaries that Allah knows that we don't, but we can speculate on where they are and we can try and be good and cultivate good intentions. And that way, it's likely that we won't be surprised when we do learn where those boundaries lie. So what I call a threshold is the kind of sense of magnitude that precedes a moral judgment. So when you have a public sphere saturated with ideas around moral performance, which of course we do everywhere, it just happens that in my field site, the anxiety about moral performance was about film and forms of public media. So when you have a public sphere saturated with ideas around film and moral performance, this is when you get these kind of emerging senses of overload, which I use to describe the term threshold. And so atmospheres and thresholds are something, you know, have a kind of duality in this book.
Thanks, that's really fascinating. And I think one of the things that I find most exciting about your framework of moral atmospheres is that away from a lot of the scholarship on ordinary ethics that looks at the individual self, what we have here is two things. One is that this is an ethics that concerns a collective. So there's collective consensus making about what is morally permissible and not. And second, that this is a zone of ethics that resides outside, you know, it concerns an ethical exteriority. So it's not just about individual deliberations or cultivating an individual interiority, but this is an ethics that resides outside of oneself and is collectively formed. And this does many things, but the thing that I find most exciting is the process of moral adjudication that follows, you know, where you place blame or moral responsibility, and especially the very interesting ways in which your traders are able to deflect blame and remove themselves from these morally contentious settings in a way that makes it quite possible, you know, that makes it possible for them to continue doing the work they do. So maybe this is a good point then to segue into the workspace and ask a more ethnographic question about the marketplace itself and the trade of these traders. Because I think the book provides us with a very fresh perspective on the informal economy through the lens of these media traders and the circulation of a range of pirated media products with varying levels of authenticity and authority. So my question is, how do these traders fashion themselves as moral economic actors in this very dynamic economic field, which has its own moral charge, but is not one that is always very clearly defined?
Thank you. So the short answer would be they position themselves as a particular kind of reliable economic actor, in a way that tries to advertise and magnify themselves as reputable, trustworthy. And because they, very few of them specialize in one genre, you know, very few of them specialize in Nazi recitations. Very few of them specialize only in Hollywood films. Some of them, very few of them specialize only in Lollywood films. You have very rare instances when they do, and that's usually because they are tied to or related to a particular collector who, from whom they get master copies and who they have a direct, you know, source that no one else has. But generally they are people who serve a very diverse customer base. So they, it's in their interest to promote themselves as being reputable, trustworthy, someone who women can come to as well as men, someone who, you know, Hindus can come to as well as Muslims, you know. And they do this by foregrounding the role of the importance of image quality and sound quality. So the one, your one anxiety about going to these markets and buying a film or buying a compilation of music is the quality of its transfer. And this goes through various interfaces, right? So you have the original interface of the celluloid reel, because up until about 2013, all Pakistani films were made in celluloids. So this was the last, one of the last world celluloid economies and industries. And so the question, so the first interface is the celluloid transfer. How aged was that film reel? How much had it been played when it was sold to the traders? So why, but also a little kind of tangent here, why piracy isn't such a salient category of knowledge is because these traders combine everything. They combine authorized, pirated, gray market, informal, everything coexists within the store. So usually the model, the Lollywood model at least, was that once films had done their rounds in the cinema and were no longer new to audiences, they would be sold to film traders who would bid on the reel, and then they would have it telescened, which means kind of transferred from celluloid, and they would be able to either sell it on to other traders, or they would also be able to sell it on with a watermark over the screen with their name and face on, and that would be priced much lower for smaller traders. Who would then be able to copy this, but they would have to copy it with this watermark on. So image quality is really, really important here, because, and not just image quality, the trustworthiness of the trader to not sell you a disc that will glitch into oblivion. So, because the danger is that they might, you might take it back to them a couple of days later and they might say, well, you didn't buy this from me. So at all levels, these traders who generally love film, but also personally believe film is impermissible and a negative public and social influence, try to promote themselves as reputable economic actors, right? And they do this by not only attempting to produce quality and not only promoting themselves as able to source things that other people can't, but also by arguing that they are more in tune and more in touch to what they call public demand than anyone else. And this means that they try to kind of feel the surface tension of public, you know, affect and sentiment, and curate their repertoires accordingly. So that they try and predict that if, you know, a Hindu family comes, they will know what they may ask for. So they kind of try and stay in touch with, you know, contemporary trends in recitation, contemporary trends in, you know, more kind of pious Bollywood film songs. They try and do lots of different things at once. And at the same time, being in tune to public demand means that if they are accused of circulating or reproducing things that people find wrong, such as pornography, they can say, well, this doesn't exist because I chose. It exists because the public wants it. You know, it's not my choice. So public demand does a lot of different things here. It's very much an economic principle, but it also provides a moral alibi to these people that they can say, well, this wasn't my creative role. I didn't, you know, do this because I wanted this to be out there. I didn't produce this or foster this. I'm just a neutral conduit. But at the same time, you know, this clashes with their attempts to say we're not neutral conduits. You know, we are able to ensure that you see a good quality print. And there's these two economic distinctions which they use that I follow in the last chapter of the book, which is found on the whole road and across South Asian media, informal media traders across the world, which is the distinction between the master copy and the camera print. So a master copy isn't an original. It's not the original film. All it is the earliest and most unblemished version of the film extant. And it's also an interface between you, the buyer, and the trader, who is the one who has access to the earliest extant copy. So you are there. So by buying a master copy that is usually priced double, you are, you know, hedging your bets that what you're going to get is going to be the best quality that you can get. Whereas camera print is something that is copied from a copy. So that would be either something grabbed from YouTube, or if a trader doesn't have a film you ask for, he may ask his friend to say, just give me your print and I'll copy it. And then he can't vouch for its quality. So it will be priced less. But all of these more kind of, you know, technological interfaces attempt to put this mode of communication between the buyer and the trader, in which the film itself becomes relatively opaque and unimportant, so to speak.
That's really fascinating. One of the things that's most exciting for me about your framework on moral atmospheres is that it gives us the tools with which to understand people's moral exteriority. You know, a lot of the scholarship on ethics is so focused with the ethical interiority of the self. But your book gives us a framework with which to understand the ethics that surrounds an individual, from which that individual can choose to take whatever distance it wants. And even as these moral atmospheres engulf these traders, they are able to, through very sort of clever maneuvers, remove themselves, you know, from that setting and deflect blame and moral responsibility onto other objects and people. So that I find very interesting. I also wanted to invite you to speak a little about your most innovative and daring chapter, where you acknowledge the presence of pollutants in these moral atmospheres, and not just moral pollutants, actual smog and smoke that chokes the air in South Asia. So yes, can we hear more from you about how you put your work on Islam and religion and public ethics in conversation with questions of climate pollution and climate change?
Thank you. Yeah. So that chapter was actually written last. That was the last thing I wrote. I felt that there was really something to be said here, which is obviously the term atmosphere is my choice, in that I chose that as the word. I translated Mahol as atmosphere when someone else could translate it as something else and make a case for it too. For that to be the correct English language term. But with atmosphere, as in Pakistan, you use Mahol to describe a biophysical atmosphere as well as you do an atmosphere, you know, like a charged political rally, or the way I use it as a kind of container for kind of coexisting or conflicting values. But atmosphere is also used in Pakistan. Mahol is also used to describe the air. And the obvious point that I thought anyone would make would be, well, the main instance when atmospheres become moral is in, you know, the scandal of air pollution and climate change, right? And Lahore is now up there with Delhi as the most polluted city on earth. And one would argue it's more polluted. It has so few air quality monitoring stations that it's often hard to know how bad things are, but they are incredibly bad. And I couldn't help think about, you know, the famous Walter Benjamin argument that, you know, that when aesthetics become politicized, when you get this kind of deadening, and that's when fascism arises. I found it was quite the contrary, that when environments and atmospheres, you know, the biophysical atmospheres become invested with deeply political and existential concerns, then maybe this is when and why you get this kind of heightened form of critique that centers on the airborne and the atmospheric. So even though I'm not sure if that chapter is clear or could ever be clear, I think it does a really important thing in that it tries, as every kind of empirical study should do, it tries to put you in not just the interpersonal and the human space, but in the kind of the climactic space where these ideas around atmosphere and the airborne get their stakes.
Yeah, and it's also another thing that it does is it really brings the conversation around climate change into a moral and political realm. And that's also so powerful. Yeah, but before we wrap up, I think our listeners will be quite curious to hear about what you're doing next and what you're up to now. Are you taking a different direction, or is your next project going to extend moral atmospheres further?
Well, unfortunately, I've probably done with atmospheres for now. I'm sure there's other ways to take it. But this was very much a kind of ethnography on its own terms rather than a life's mission. My next book project emerges from the fourth chapter in the book, which worked with 12 Ashia videographers. So this was a real turning point in the book, in ways that I'll leave it up to the reader to find out why. But the second book project is, it documents how Pakistan's largest religious minority established this kind of immersive style of videography in the face of violent persecution. So in the early 1980s, the 12 Ashia, particularly in Lahore, began to document on video and sound recordings the practices of Azadari, which means the commemorative mourning for figures in early Islamic history, that's really central to their ethical lives. Now, what's my kind of contribution to this is I worked with and remain good friends with probably the first videographer who bought audio and video cassette hardware back from his life as an expatriate labourer in the Gulf in like 1983. So when he started recording, several years later, there arose a kind of countrywide Shia recording industry that gave life to the careers of reciters of laments and praise poems and the kind of consolidation of like a studio network and a mass kind of countrywide circulation of cassettes and CDs and things like that. But what my videographer friend wanted to do was he wanted to distinguish between what he did, between realism and the artificiality of studios. And so what he did was he borrowed the term used for television broadcasts and location recordings, and he described his recordings as live. Live as a diary, live mourning. Now, this term caught on, and now, or at least in 2017, Shia video houses all describe their location recordings, and also the ones done in kind of small prayer gatherings, as live, as very much distinct from the studio recordings. Now, in 2016, you had something interesting happening, which was Facebook Live launched. YouTube was unbanned, and it already had a live stream function. So you got these new digital collectives that arose in the late 2010s, who then used the same term. They promote themselves as doing live as a diary, live morning. But their definition of liveness is related to a different kind of technological affordance, but gathers its meaning and resonance from the work of the videographers that came before them. So this book project is, following the salience of liveness in Xi theology, media practice, and the field of visual anthropology. And it takes this invitation to fuse Islamic theology and art and media theory offered by this notion of live mourning. That's what I'm trying to do next.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. Tim, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today. Moral Atmospheres is a fascinating book that offers deep and nuanced perspectives on the intersections of morality, religion, media, and marketplace dynamics. So thank you for writing it, and thank you for talking to us about it today.
Thank you, Garima.